Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My next guest, Sister Helen Prejean, is an international speaker and author on the topic of capital punishment. Her first book, which shares her experiences of counseling a man on death row, was on the New York Times bestseller list for 31 weeks and turned into the major motion picture Dead Man Walking, starring Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn. She is in Pittsburgh for a speaking engagement at Rodef Shalom Congregation, and she joins me live in Studio A. Sister Helen Prejean, it's an honor to have you. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Great to be here, Paul.
Your involvement with the issue of capital punishment seems to have begun in earnest over three decades ago. What was it that inspired your moral and spiritual philosophy?
Well, first learning about human rights. I started to be educated about human rights, that everybody has a right to live. No one should be subjected to cruel and degrading punishment or torture. And as a Catholic, traditional Catholic, it had kind of been, the state has a right to kill. I never questioned it. But when I lived among poor and struggling African Americans in the inner city in New Orleans is when I started learning everything from a different point of view. And it was when I was there working at a place called Hope House that I got this invitation to write a man. I didn't even think they were going to execute him. I didn't know much about the death penalty. I had just awakened to the issues of social justice. And because it was the early 80s, we hadn't had an execution in Louisiana in over 20 years because there'd been an unofficial moratorium starting in the 60s through the 70s. In 76, the Supreme Court put the death penalty back. I didn't notice. Didn't affect me. And then, lo and behold, I write this man. I visit him, and 2 years later, I accompany him, and he looks at my face when they kill him in the electric chair. And along that road, I also met the victims' families. And at first made a very bad mistake. I stayed away from them thinking that they wouldn't want to meet the nun who was a spiritual advisor to the man who had killed their children. There were two teenagers killed in the most brutal, cold-blooded way you can imagine. They'd gone to a football game, gone to a place, a local lover's lane to park, and they are found lying dead on the grass with bullet holes in the backs of their heads, and the girl had been raped. She was Loretta Bourk. The boy was David LeBlanc. I'm drawn into this whole vortex, and I didn't think they'd want to see me because I was a spiritual advisor to Patrick Sonnier and his brother Eddie, and I made the worst possible mistake. I didn't even write him a note to say I'm so sorry about your son or daughter. They met me in the most polarized situation you can imagine, which was a pardon board hearing. The last step before Pat was to be executed, his brother had gotten a life sentence, and that's when I met them. And it was the father of David LeBlanc who came right up to me. His name is Lloyd. He said, "Sister Helen, all this time you've been visiting with those two brothers, and you didn't once come to see us? Sister, you can't imagine all the pressure they're putting on me for this death penalty. They all telling me that if I'm not for the death penalty, it looks like I didn't love my son David, that I got to be for the death penalty, and I haven't had anybody to talk to." And he was the first victim's family I met who began to take me through their struggles and what they go through.
How did your correspondence with Patrick Sonnier begin?
I was asked by a member of the Louisiana Coalition of Jails and Prisons if I wanted to be a pen pal with somebody on death row. So they gave me his name. I wrote him a letter. And he wrote back, and I wrote, he wrote.
What did you say in your letter?
I mean, just ordinary stuff. You know, it's just like, "Hi, I'm Sister Helen Prejean." I sent him a picture of myself. The only one I had was on this little pony in the woods, and I said, "I'm the one with two legs." And sent him a picture of Christ on the cross, but it was too big. It didn't fit the prison. I started to learn about prison rules. That picture got ejected, but they let me through the photograph of me on the horse. And we just started corresponding. And out of his letters, because he never asked anything. I mean, never even asked me to come or send him money for cigarettes, anything. I found out he had no one to visit him. So it kind of evolved. It was like very organic. "Oh, you got nobody to visit you. Well, look, I'll come see you sometime." And then I began to come regularly because I realized he didn't have anybody else. I didn't know anything about the law or the courts or the appeals courts or the Supreme Court or how things worked. In my second book, The Death of Innocence, I know a lot about how the courts work. And I even take on Justice Scalia, some of the arguments, the way he interprets the Constitution. Because I can see on the ground the way this thing really works. And they may say it's only for the worst of the worst, the guidelines the Supreme Court gave. But you know who it is? You look on the ground, who gets it? Overwhelmingly people who kill white people. And then if it's a person of color kills a white person, well, boy, you really up 14 notches. Always poor people and geographically located in certain parts of the country. You even look at Pennsylvania. You had hot spots where DAs would go for the death penalty all the time. Right next door, DA never went for the death penalty. And so we have this sporadic, arbitrary way that it's carried out, disproportionately always against poor people. The very reason, Paul, that the Supreme Court in the Furman decision of 72 overturned the death penalty, because they said it's arbitrarily and capriciously applied and disproportionately applied to poor people and minorities. It's the same today, but they stay in their theory and they don't come down and look at the ground.
So you say that the death penalty is not only ineffective, but it's also inefficient.
Well, ineffective, inefficient, that's pretty synonymous. But it's morally wrong because, and see what I do in my book, Dead Man Walking, and what I do in the talks like I'll be doing tonight, you know, in the synagogue, is bring people close to the reality of what it actually means for the state to kill a human being, like the guards who have to do the killing for us. What happens to them? Suddenly they find themselves on the execution squad, and they got to take a live man from that cell, and they got to accompany him and strap him down. They practice in Louisiana. They practice when he goes quietly or when he fights them, and they got to kill that man that night, and they're being told, it's just your job. I tell the story of Felton Cootie, who was the supervisor of death row in Louisiana, and how after 5 executions, he called me in his office and he said, I know their crimes. I know everybody on death row because I was the supervisor. But boy, when you see a man's defenseless like that, and then you're part of the team of people that kills him, I come home after these executions, I can't sleep and I can't eat. So you got to tell everybody's story, including the victims' families. And I had a really good editor at Random House. In fact, we're getting ready to reissue Dead Man Walking. It's a 20-year anniversary. Next month, it's going to be reissued. And we have Archbishop Tutu, who wrote the preface. And we have Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins, both wrote an afterword about what it was like to do the movie and work on the film and all together. And I did an afterword about where we are 20 years later. But my editor, Jason Epstein, and he told me, now look, you're a Catholic nun. Your spiritual advisor to a murderer on death row who did an unspeakable crime. And if you don't talk about that crime in the first 10 pages of this book, nobody's going to read your book. Because they're going to think, oh, well, she's a nun and she's going to say Jesus said to forgive. They're going to expect every religious platitude in the books to come from your lips. And you got to bring people in the first 10 pages and look at that crime and the suffering of that family. And then to raise the moral question, so what should we do? And then you got to take people with you step by step into the horror of what it means to take a live human being and put him to death.
How did you get past what Patrick Saunier had done? How did you get past the crime that he committed in order to see him in a human way?
It's interesting, your choice of words, how did I get past it? I never got past it. But when I'm looking in a man's eyes, and I know what he did, but I was just with some Quakers, and they said, everyone has the light in them. He's more than that one act. There was also goodness in this man and remorse in this man. And everybody I discovered through him is more than the worst act of their life. But it put me in a terrible kind of ambivalence because I was always, once I'm at the victims' families and knew their sufferings, holding in my heart at the same time this fierce, well, here he is. I know he shouldn't be killed. He's a human being. But then the suffering of the victim's family. And what I've learned over these 25 years of doing this and being with victims' families, you know, sometimes you'll see there was a trial. They go for the death penalty. You see the victim's family come out with a V sign. We won. We won. He got death. And then they start waiting 10 years, 15 years. And I've seen them along the way while they're waiting for this so-called justice that they'll get to witness. Some, very few, you know, it's less than 1% of all the people who experience homicide who are given this so-called justice. It's just pure symbolism. It's political symbolism. It's not about really stopping crime.
What do you say to people who argue that a murderer has no excuse, has taken the life of another, and therefore does not deserve to live, and someone who, as a parent, says, I cannot come peace, I cannot be at peace with this unless this man or woman dies?
That's the way most victims' families, that's usually the first thing out of their mouth. But that's not where most of them stay. Because, in fact, a victim's family said that, those very words to me. Her daughter had been killed. She said, I can't stand the thought that even if he gets life without parole, he's still alive and she's dead, and that's wrong. That's unfair. I can't be at peace till I see him dead. And that's the way people start out. But then there's life, and they have other children. And that all that energy that's going in to see him dead, like Lloyd LeBlanc, the father of David, his journey is the one that I tell in most intimacy in Dead Man Walking. And the way he put it was, I was putting all my energy into wanting to see them dead and all this anger and bitterness coming into me. I wish I could pull the switch. But then I didn't like what was happening to me because I was filled with that hatred. I wanted to do to them what they did to our son. And then he said, they killed my son, but I'm not going to let them kill me. And he set his face to go down the road in love with his family and people around him so that he wouldn't lose his integrity as a person. He had always been a kind person who loved to help people. And then he saw himself losing that because he was taken over by the hatred. That's a struggle.
How does a murderer retain their humanity?
Well, I've accompanied 6 human beings to execution. And each of them that I have accompanied with varying degrees of consciousness about what they did. One man I was with, Willie Celestine, was on drugs. He completely blacked out the murder. He wasn't denying it. This is an hour before he's to be killed. He said, I'm not denying it, but I don't remember a thing. And the way all of them that I've been with, including him, the last words were to ask forgiveness of the victim's family. One, Robert Lee Willie, said to the family, I hope this brings you some peace. And they all said words like that and then died with as much dignity as they could muster. In the death of innocence, I'm with 2 people I believe are innocent. And with Dobie Gillis Williams, African-American man, IQ 65, railroaded this little town, Manny, Louisiana, for the killing of a white woman in her house. His last words were to the warden, who was saying, Dobie, anything you want to tell me? He had disobeyed his mama. And whenever he disobeyed his mama, he got into trouble. He was out drinking with friends the night he was supposed to be home, led to all the trouble because he was up around 11 o'clock at night, all this, that he had disobeyed his mama. He had an IQ of 65. And so he just said, I'm sorry I brought all this trouble on my mama. Those were his words to the warden. And people do the best they can. And I got to have a direct dialogue with Pope John Paul about the Catholic Church teaching and saying it's filled with loopholes and people quoting Catholic teaching to justify doing the death penalty. And I said,
an eye for an eye.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And I just said to the Pope, I said, when I'm walking with a man to execution and he's shackled hand and foot, surrounded by 6 guards who are going to strap him down and kill him, and he says, Sister, just pray God holds up my legs. That's a way a person tries to show their dignity, that they walk to their execution. I said, where's the dignity? Does the Catholic Church only uphold the dignity of innocent life? Well, what about guilty life?
What did the Pope say?
He changed the catechism. I wasn't the only one, of course, in dialogue, but I had a direct dialogue with him. And he changed the catechism of the Catholic Church to strengthen its opposition. And then when he came to St. Louis, after that in 1999, for the first time, he put in the death penalty with the other pro-life issues that Catholics are used to hearing. No to abortion, euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide. And he said a no to the death penalty because it's cruel. Our Supreme Court won't acknowledge torture. But he says, because it's cruel and unnecessary, we have a way to keep ourselves safe without killing people. And he said, even those among us who have done a terrible crime have a dignity that must not be taken from them. And then there was a move within the Catholic Church in the United States to be much more assertive in teaching and upholding. And there's been a real shift in Catholic opinion about the death penalty. In 96, 80% of Catholics believed in the death penalty. Today, it's less than 50% because of teaching, because of bringing people there and saying, what are we doing? What do the teachings of Jesus mean anyway? Why you keep quoting this eye for an eye thing? Jesus said, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye. But I say to you, well, who are we as Christians? Like, are we domesticated Christianity? We all culturalize. We sound just like everybody else. And we justify taking a person, rendering them defenseless and killing them? Why? In whose name are we doing that?
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer here on 90.5 WESA. My guest is Sister Helen Prejean, the author of Dead Man Walking. How did you embark on writing Dead Man Walking?
Well, when I came out of the execution chamber after Patrick, he was the first one. He was electrocuted to death, and I was there, and he looked at me. I came out of that execution chamber, and I threw up. It's the middle of the night. And I remember thinking, the people are never going to get close to this. They're going to hear about the crime. They're going to read the newspaper. Justice was done. He was executed. And reflection's over. I've been brought close. I got to tell the story. First, I did it with talking. Then I began to write. And then a friend of mine, Jason DeParle, who works for the New York Times now, he had a writer friend. And who gave me his literary agent in New York, Gloria Loomis. And she had a friend, Jason Epstein, at the Random House. She walked right down the street, gave him my manuscript, first-time author. And I was explaining before how he helped me shape the story. Without Jason, I wrote this in the afterword with reissuing the book. Without Jason, I wouldn't have known you got to shape the story so that you bring people fairly over to both sides, and me caught in the middle, in over my head, trying to figure it out. And so the reader can kind of come with me, because clearly I'm in over my head. And then I wrote it in first person, present tense, so as it happens to me, it happens to the reader. It's the first book I ever wrote.
You've written a second book called The Deaths of Innocence, as you mentioned, and it's an eyewitness account of wrongful executions, which details the trials and executions of two men you believed were innocent. What led you to believe that they were innocent?
Well, there's a whole visiting them over a whole number of years, like Dobie Gillis Williams, the African-American man. It was over 10 years. Joseph O'Dell, the second story in the book, I was with less, but there was a whole group of people trying to get him to get the courts to do the testing. And that's how I found out how the courts can kill you. I learned, for example, that when you have your trial, if your lawyer does not present a formal argument of opposition of things that happened during your trial, the appeals courts won't pick up the issue later. Like Dobie, a black man in this little southern town accused of killing a white woman, he looks out at the jury of his peers, the fair and impartial jury of his peers, and it's all white people from the town. How could the Supreme Court of the United States uphold that? How, you know how they upheld it? They said, your lawyer didn't raise a formal objection to the seating of the jury, but he said I had a terrible lawyer who didn't do anything for me. Sorry. Not perfect, but that's the way it goes. And so I begin to learn all of these things. So that's accompanying people and reading and getting to know the facts over a period of time. And so it's not lightly. But, you know, I understand better structurally now why. It's almost inevitable. It is inevitable. Because, see, the place to get to the truth is during trial. And you take the Deep South states where you have an overworked, underpaid defense counsel who maybe has 100 cases, three of which are capital cases. And that's supposed to be your defense. There's no way they can prepare. There's no way they even have the adequate energy a lot of times to go up against prosecution. Who's in control of the evidence? And they have to go hat in hand to ask for money to conduct independent testing of the forensic evidence. A lot of times they just don't give them the money. So we don't have an adversarial way to come to truth, and it's slam dunk. And then the appeals courts deny it because the lawyer who was inadequate didn't raise formal objections. 142 wrongfully convicted people have come off a death row, say by college students, in these innocence projects. College kids are doing it, and that shows how broken it is. So it's inevitable that some of the people who go are going to be the innocent along with the guilty, the way I see it now. I've been with six people on death row, two of them that have been killed are innocent, and the man I'm with in Louisiana right now, Manuel Ortiz from El Salvador, has been on death row 20 years. I'm absolutely convinced of his innocence, and we're just beginning to have hearings to show his innocence, and I don't know if it's going to prevail or not.
Many parts of America have the death penalty. We have the death penalty here in Pennsylvania. So what needs to happen with the death penalty, in your opinion?
We got to educate the people, and people have to see that the death penalty doesn't help anybody. There's a lot that needs to be done for victims of violent crime, a lot to be done to help them, to the shattered families. They need counseling. They lose their jobs. They need all kinds of help. And you're going to sink all the money down the hole of killing one person out of I don't know how many. And look at Pennsylvania. How long have you had the death penalty on the books? 25 years, whatever? How many people have you actually executed during all this time? Like three. And you have over 200 people sitting on death row. I was just in California. They have 722 people sitting on death row. And they execute on average every 20 years because the legal machinery of the appeals courts with the Supreme Court clogs it down.
So how do you get rid of it? Can we get rid of
it? Yeah, of course we can. Look, in the last 6 years, six states have put it down. Maryland just did it. Before, New York, New Jersey, New Mexico, Illinois, Connecticut, then Maryland. And Pennsylvania can do it too. And part of it is just look at the cost analysis. Wouldn't it be better to be putting this money into law enforcement with unsolved murders or people who are raped, or put it into the law enforcement in the community where it's going to help everybody instead of sinking it down the black hole? And then involving ourselves as a society. Where else in the criminal justice system do we ever say, their crime was so terrible, we're going to imitate them, and we're going to do to them what they did to their victim. You kill, we're going to kill you. And see, along this road, I've met all these people that get involved in doing a killing for us, the guards. You know, I tell the story in Dead Man Walking, Feltus Cootie. He was the supervisor on death row in Louisiana. And after five executions, he called me in. He goes, sister, I'm not going to be able to keep doing this. He said, I don't even have to strap them on the gurney. But I just take a paper sack after they killed, and I go collect their toothbrush and their personal possessions. I go home. I sit in my lazy boy chair. I can't eat. I can't sleep. Because in my gut, I know I'm being involved in killing somebody who's been rendered defenseless. And I know all their crimes because I know every one of them. But, boy, when you're close to it like that, and, you know, I push people in the audience when I'm bringing them there close to this on both sides and just say, when we're outraged over crime and we say they ought to die, well, could you do it? Could you be the one personally to do it? Or you got to hire somebody to do it for you and you don't want to be anywhere near it? And most people go, well, I don't know if I could do it. When people are in a state of rage, they say, oh, yeah, I could do it. But really, when it comes down to it, you know what they have to put on the death certificate after an execution, cause of death? You know what they have to write?
What do they write?
Homicide. Because it means a human being killing another human being. Now, Texas puts legal homicide by way of execution. But the key word is homicide. And look how bankrupt that is morally. That the only thing we can think to do with people who kill is to kill them.
My guest has been Sister Helen Prejean. She is the author of Dead Man Walking. She has written a second book called The Deaths of Innocence, an eyewitness account of wrongful execution. Sister Helen, it's been a pleasure having
you. Paul, great to talk to you. Thank you.